think I got the bird flu. I'm tired of salad packs, I think I need a bird or two. I think I got the bird flu. I'm tired of selling packs, I think I need a bird.
We selling scramble coop, it's smack, 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 we selling scramble coop, it's smack. Keep them junkies coming back.
We selling scramble coop, it's smack. The dope so good, I let the junkie hit it once, he damn near had a heart attack. If you cop from me, I guarantee you coming right back. We got that real morphine, you niggas using Percocet. I'm in the track, counting stacks, on point like a tack. Selling dope, out the house, blowing smoke out my mouth. Got the
red Laura Scooter, whose life was ended a couple of days ago here in the streets of Baltimore after he attended a peace rally, one of our leading hip-hop artists. Who was on his way to go national. But the other bigger issue here we will deal with on Wednesday on this program in memory of him and others is why Baltimore is once again becoming the murder capital of the United States of America and what we can do about it as a city and as a community coming together. And my dear friend Lawrence Brown, who's here in the studio to talk about a different issue today, has written eloquently about that. Maybe we can tease him back in the studio Wednesday because about what the roots of that are beyond just what we say is personal behavior conduct. But whatever, it's a very complex thing. And it does tie in many ways to me to Port Covington, because Port Covington has everything to do with the poverty in the city, the dislocation in the city, the people not being allowed to be part of the process, not benefiting from the process, jobs that aren't paying the wages need to pay to make people stable so they can have families and grow. And that's how violence ends and more ends in this town. So Port Covington covers a lot, which is what we're about to do today. But we go out, so our hearts, of course, go out to Laura Scooter and go out to all the families of men and women who have been killed in the city, and we will be tackling that on Wednesday. But once it could not go through today without at least hearing his sound a bit and mentioning him and mentioning that. In the studio, Dr. Lawrence Brown, assistant professor in the Department of Community Health and Policy at Morgan State University. He has recently a New York Times op-ed on the latest not guilty verdict in the death of Freddie in the death of Freddie Gray, officers accused in the death of Freddie Gray, titled "More Injustice in Baltimore." He tweets at "Be More Doc," and has also created this new Facebook page called Brace, which stands for
Baltimore Redevelopment Action Coalition for Empowerment.
And it's been incredible conversations that are taking place on that page, and I encourage people to go to Brace on Facebook and join in those conversations and be part of that, because it's where a different kind of conversation is taking place. And Dr. Lawrence Brown has been in the forefront of that, testifying in city council, being there at all the meetings around Port Covington and more. So it's great to have him back in the studio. Welcome back, man. Good to have you.
Man, thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Good to have you back.
Absolutely.
And Charlie Carter joins us by phone, Executive Director of Maryland Working Families. Charlie, welcome. Good to have you with us again.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Always good to have you.
Thank you for covering this important issue.
And Melody Simmons joins us, who reports for the Baltimore Business Journal, covering real estate and economic development, and has been following Port Covington intensely and was on the show just last week talking about it. And Melody, welcome back as well.
Thank you, Mark. It's good to be back.
And you all can join us at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org by email. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. You can also log on to our Facebook pages. Pardon me. Do join us at 410-319-8888. And this Friday, we'll probably be having a conversation with Barbara Samuels, excuse me, from the American Civil Liberties Union, who, along with the Public Justice Center, put out a 13-page letter to the Planning Commission offering an alternative to what the people have been passing. We'll talk more in depth about that with her as well. We'll raise those issues today. But 410-319-8888. But, Lawrence, let me turn to you first, if I might. So talk about a bit about politically why you become so socially and politically involved and impassioned on this issue, among others. I mean, what has driven you to this place?
Well, as I wrote to Planning Commissioner Chairman Thomas Stosser for Baltimore City Department of Planning, here that the fate and future of the city has a lot to do with Port Covington. Most people hone in on the $660 million TIF that would be issued on behalf of Port Covington or Sagamore / Under Armour / Kevin Plank. But there's also $760.4 million that would be bestowed upon Sagamore in tax breaks And that's actually the most immediate impact. Part of that $313 million comes from the enterprise zone tax credits that they would receive, and another $445 million would come from the brownfield rehabilitation tax credits they would receive. I'm doubtful that there's $445 million worth of brownfield rehabilitation to be done in Port Covington. So let's, I think maybe $100 million would be fine, but $445 million, that's a whole lot. Then you have $313 million for that enterprise zone, which really is supposed to be targeted towards communities that have high unemployment specifically. So it's not enough to say, well, we're going to create 10,000 jobs for Baltimore City. No, no, no. It's supposed to be targeted towards especially the communities whose demographics were used to create that enterprise zone. We've seen nothing about that in the Port Covington master plan or in their TIF application. So the question for me is the impact that this $760 million is going to have on our budget. We know that there's a state of emergency due to lead poisoning in Baltimore City. We could use that money to help eliminate the hazard of lead poison. We could be providing affordable housing. At the hearing, Mark Weller, or their attorney, was saying that, oh, it's hard to put this type of burden of providing affordable housing on developers. Well, we're giving you $740 million worth of tax credits. So that's the burden. The burden is on what we could be doing with that money. And if you're not going to provide affordable housing, if you're not going to provide fair housing, if you're not going to do the things that we should and could be doing with this money, then I think there's a real problem. And I think it poses the problem of creating or producing more Freddie Grays, more violence, like the violence that killed Laura Scooter, because we're not investing in black neighborhoods. We're investing in a neighborhood that's at the corner of the White L.
I want to come back to the White L and the Black Butterfly and talk a bit more about that and that theory of development and where we are in Baltimore. But Charlie Carter, talk a bit about what your organization and how you're involved in this.
Certainly. You know, our Maryland Working Families is, we pride ourselves on being a movement made up of people in the community, engaging people around issues and policies that impact their lives. And we've seen over the last several years, tax break, TIF application, development after development, in which wealthy developers come in and our city leaders roll over and give them tax breaks while failing to invest in neighborhoods like Sandtown, Winchester, like Oliver, like Warburg, like Cherry Hill. And we've seen this repeatedly. And we decided to get involved in this issue because we saw this, how, what a fast track this was on. And it was very clear that the money that Sagamore was putting behind this deal, and Under Armour was putting behind this deal, was meant to steamroll it before the community could have its questions answered, before anybody could really question whether or not this was a sound investment for the taxpayers of Baltimore. And we have, you know, serious concerns about the process that's been followed, about the fiscal responsibility, whether this is fiscally appropriate for Baltimore at this time, and definitely the equity issues that Lawrence raises.
And Melody, the where are we now with all this? It passed the planning department passed the deal with Port Covington, which we'll talk in more detail about in the next half an hour. And where are we now? What happens next?
Well, the vote was unanimous. I want to say that. There was a lot of passionate testimony on both sides. It was a long hearing. It was emotionally draining. And then the Planning Commission voted unanimously to pass the master plan. And so where we stand now is that the master plan is in play, and it will be used as a blueprint document by Sagamore Development to move forward with design plans, with zoning recommendations and zoning changes that need to be done down on the Port Covington Peninsula, and then any other kind of development that they might have planned. Also, I think it boosts their attempt to get the tax packages, the tax incentive packages, just by saying, well, the master plan was approved by the city. So we have a lot of things moving and moving very fast. And I think that there's a lot of questions that still remain. This is what we heard last week in the testimony, that there are a lot of questions that are still on the table that haven't been answered.
So I'm going to open the phones here and then come right back to all the issues we've just raised here and a kind of our overview. And, folks, we will be talking about this TIF, talking about Port Covington with some intensity over this next month. July 27th is the beginning of the City Council hearings being chaired by Councilman Carl Stokes and his committee. And then they have to send a recommendation to the City Council as a whole to vote on whether or not to approve this plan or to amend this plan being made with Sagamore Development for the building Port Covington. Sagamore Development, of course, the development arm of Kevin Plank's business world, and of course the man who founded Under Armour, an international company here that was built out of Baltimore. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join in on this conversation. Michael, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing today, man? I love that show.
Thank you. We're doing well.
Thank you again. Basically, I'm originally from Brooklyn, New York, and when I first came out here to visit, like in 88, 89, 90 area, and when I first came down, and for some weird reason, I was on Perrin Parkway and Putty Hill, and it was a rally of the KKK rallying, and I was like, wow, this is kind of scary to me. And then when I moved out here back in like 98, and I visited and I came back and forth, and what I learned is there's a lot of people that's from Maryland that was born and raised here. There are so many different ties in with the city and the counties as well, and they control a lot of things that nobody really can understand of why they have so much power or why certain things would never be changed. So as far as when it comes down to the public housing, originally, the only way that you can keep something down to where the property value will go up is if we have a lot of crime and negative things in certain neighborhoods, like in John Hopkins. So around that area, they let the crime rate go crazy for a long period of time. Then once the property value dropped so dramatically, and that's when they said, we're going to move everybody out and we're going to bring in the new developers to develop all of this land around here. Because I work as a contractor for cable, so when I'm going into these new apartments, the apartment is like $2,500 a month, up to $4,000 a month, right on Wolf Street, where the crime rate was over excessive just a couple years ago, and the rate over there for rent was like $600 a month
right.
for a 3-4 bedroom. So when it comes down to certain things, when it comes to Larry Hogan, he took all the money out of the city for school systems in Baltimore counties, and certain Baltimore counties, not all. And then he said, well, I'm building a new jail for the right. inner city people to go to. Which, it's a setup for failure. Like we put him in office. I don't believe we voted for him, but he's in office and to shake things up. So now he's there, and he took all the money out of the county and the cities to build a brand new jail for people that live in the city and the surrounding counties.
So, Michael, you're raising very strong points, and I think that some of the issues you raised, Michael Lawrence Brown, are the kind of things that go to the heart of the question of how we spend the development money, which I think is part of your thrust in all of this, mm-hmm. is just how we spend the money, what we spend it on.
Well, you know, Michael raises a couple of important points. One, when you think about the money that's taken out of Baltimore City, you don't have to look to Governor Hogan. You can look to Baltimore City elected officials, which are Democrats. You can look at the amount of funding that we lost to our school district last year because of the TIF, the Harbor Point TIF, which caused an increase in land value, and because of the state funding formula, caused a decrease in $24 million in terms of the funding that goes to our public schools. Now, there's been a temporary 3-year bill passed to sort of put that on hold. But what's going to be the long-term impact of this on our public schools? Yet another question that is not being answered satisfactorily. So I think that's one huge issue. The other issue that he raises, I think, is quite important. You look at what happened to EBDI, And it's just sort of there's this continuum of, you know, they received $78 million in TIF funding. Michael Beatty, $107 million in TIF funding. Patrick Turner, $160 million in Westport. And now Kevin Plank owns that land. Sagamore owns that land, 40 acres there. So you have the concentration of power in the hands of these folks that are receiving these TIFs. And there's a long history of both failure in terms of their impact of positively affecting the black community. Michael Beatty received $88 million in enterprise zone funding by redrawing the enterprise zone around Perkins Homes. And they didn't receive anything, and now their development is going to be torn down. So, I mean, the way that this plays out, where the rich white developers win at the expense of black community people, is what we're afraid of, and I think what needs to be really examined, the racial equity implications of this need to be really examined.
And also, Mark, I wanted to point out that Dr. Brown brought up the EBDI development. Last week at the BDC board meeting, a pilot was introduced and approved by the BDC board. That's another tax break for the EBDI area for a developer there, Penrose. They want to put up a big apartment development there, and they need a pilot, payment in lieu of taxes, which means that over a 15-year period, they're going to pay little to no property tax taxes on their development. And that flies in the face of the TIF, because the TIF needs to be repaid with profits from residential areas. This is what all the documents in EBDI say. That was never brought up at the EBDI, at the BDC meeting. It wasn't discussed. And I talked to the chair of the committee that considered the pilot and recommended it to the entire board, and she told me that it wasn't even discussed in the committee. So there's a lot of there's a lot of moving parts, and they have interplay with each other. And where's the follow-up that, that they look, you have a TIF. Is the TIF being repaid? Is the now with the layer of a pilot? What is that going to do to the TIF repayment schedule that's already in motion with the city?
So this is in addition to what happened with EBDI before. And where are these apartments? Right. Do you know?
Where is what?
Where are the apartments to be built?
The apartments are going to be built on Wolf Street, right next door to the 929 building, mm-hmm. which is also known as the Graduate Student Tower. And it's going to be a very large apartment development. Take up a whole block, and it's going to have a component of townhomes, rental townhomes as well. And in all the documentation that was filed to get the TIF, they laid out that they would be repaying the TIF with property taxes diverted from new residential development and some private development for Biopark. And the Biopark has been very slow-moving, it gets in the weeds, but basically if Hopkins is involved with a Biopark, the taxing is lower, the property taxing is lower, because they have different tax rates. So market rate apartments are going to be generating the money to pay back the TIF. And here comes a pilot that is now headed towards City Hall that is going to basically cut at the knees the repayment of the TIF. So it makes no sense.
Not to mention the Live Near Your Work subsidy that people receive if they work for Hopkins as a full-time benefit-earning employee, up to $36,000 to live within a mile radius of the EBDI footprint in the Middle East community. So,
and also, it's also for people who buy and work around
near Homewood as well.
Homewood, Johns
yes.
Hopkins University, Charles Village.
Exactly.
Right.
So what we're saying is people are spending money to – we're displacing our low-income black population, and we're incentivizing the influx of a predominantly white workforce that works at Johns Hopkins in the professional level to move into these communities. So that's gentrification. Port Covington may not feature that as strongly right now, but the concern has to be, once that Port Covington is built up, what's going to happen to Westport? What's going to happen to Cherry Hill? They're going to have tremendous gentrification pressures as well.
It seems to me, and I'm going to come. Is that you, Melody?
Yes, I'm here.
Were you about to say something?
Well, I was going to say that there's a long timeline on Port Covington, as we all know. It's going to be built out over 25 years. The TIF repayment, according to the TIF documents, which are lengthy, 500-plus pages, show a repayment schedule over 40 years, up to 40 years. So that's a long time. It's a long timeline, and who's going to be minding the store? You wonder who in city government, and this question has been asked by journalists, how is it going to play out? Who's going to monitor it? Who's going to watch it? And we haven't really been able to get solid answers on that over the
years. This raises a really important issue, Mark,
and that is
the question that we've been raising from the beginning. Well, actually, two questions. One is, what is the process? And, you know, we've seen Harbor East, we've seen Harbor Point, we've seen EBDI, now we're seeing, we've seen Westport, now we've seen three iterations of TIFs, or tax financing, tax subsidies for Port Covington. This latest one with Sagamar is the third one where taxpayers have been asked to invest. We're asking, what is the process? Why aren't we following a process? We have standards set in place. Standards that say you have to meet a certain threshold for affordable inclusionary housing. Standards that say, that speak to employment, that speak to what is the impact and what will be the benefit of the community that's surrounding, drawn into the TIF zone. And yet what we're seeing is including with the master plan, we see approval of a master plan that does not meet or fall into alignment with the Baltimore City master plan. We see the city leaders and the BDC that are approving, we're being asked, although the Port Covington plan is a 25-year build-out, Baltimore City is being asked to commit $535 million right now, which would be the largest TIF proposal in the country. The next largest one took 18 months to pass.
So,
and we're trying to pass this in 6 months when questions like the one Natalie just asked, like, who's going to be minding the store? The answer is nobody's minding the store right now because we have rules and standards that our city leaders aren't even willing to apply to this, which says, in this town, if you have money, you get to make the rules. And for the rest of us, you know, we just get to play along and deal with the fallout. And, you know, that's why working families and the 22 organizations that we're in coalition with are saying we need to slow this process down. We need to hold off on any decision for at least a few months until we can get the answers to the questions about how this will impact our communities going forward.
Jeff Singer has just emailed in at talkastanashow.org. He said, the new apartments, talking about the EBDI thing, the new apartments are specifically not, in capital letters, affordable because the Baltimore Development Corporation says East Baltimore doesn't need any more low-income housing.
That's right. That's what they said in the meeting.
What it doesn't need any more low-income housing?
Well, there was a commitment to, when they first put the EBDI plan forth, one-third, one-third, one-third. One-third affordable housing, one-third market rate, and one-third workforce development. So that was kind of the plan when they put forth how they wanted to rebuild residential. However, what's happened is there is a lot of apartments. There's a senior apartment there, and there is an affordable housing apartment development there. And talk with Ray Skinner at EBDI, who said that they are at the one-third. They have met their one-third commitment of units for affordable housing already. So these are going to be market rate.
And, of course, affordable housing might meet an intern at Johns Hopkins University, not a poor person working in a plant somewhere who lives in East Baltimore.
Correct, yeah. I mean, it's really, I think that there was some talk early on about offering rental units, affordable rental units, to some of the residents who are displaced, who might want to come back. I don't really know what the efforts are on that because we can't get any information on that. Annie Casey is doing a survey right now, and we have not been able to get the results of the survey or any timetable. And that survey would center on the people who were displaced and moved out, and where are they today? Do they want to move back? Where would they move back if they could? So there's a lot of questions about that, and that's just the EBDI project.
So I'd like to see more about that. And Melody Simmons, I know you have to run, reporter for BBJ, Baltimore Business Journal, covering real estate and economic development, who's been covering Port Covington intensely. Melody, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mark. Good talking to you.
Always. And Charlie Carter, Executive Director of Maryland Working Families, and Dr. Lawrence Brown of Morgan State University will remain. We'll come right back. And Charlie and Tom, you're the first two callers up. We'll take your calls when we come. Return 410-319-8888. Stay with us. Here with Dr. Lawrence Brown, assistant professor in the Department of Community Health and Policy at Morgan State University. Recent op-ed in the New York Times called More Injustice in Baltimore, tweets at Be More Doc, and has created Brace, this new Facebook page that you all should check out and become part of that conversation. Charlie Carter, executive director of Maryland Working Families, and you at 410-319-8888. On the way to the conversation, I just have to give you one quick notice here. I forgot to do before we went to break. I want to let you know about an upcoming event in Baltimore, The Rise of Charm City, WEAA's new innovative audio documentary series, producing a partnership with the Association of Independence and Radio, is wrapping up its inaugural 12-episode season. To celebrate that, WEAA and show creator Stacia Brown invite you to an elegant evening of live storytelling that honors the history of some of Baltimore City's most beloved businesses and neighborhoods. The event's taking place on Thursday, July 14th, from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Frederick Douglass Isaac Myers Maritime Museum. Dessert and wine reception will follow. Tickets and more information at Baltimore: The Rise of Charm City on Facebook, and come join us there. It'll be a great evening. These women have put together one of the most incredible new shows I've heard in a long time, so we're celebrating all of that. So let's go back to the phones, if we might. 410-319-8888. Charlie in Baltimore, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi there. I have a question for Lawrence Brown. So I'm a little bit, you know, dizzy looking at all of the maybe steps in the process of coming to where we're at with the Port Covington development. And I'm wondering, just, you know, for the sake of maybe applying political pressure where it's due, given that so many people's voices were ignored leading up to the decision made by the Planning Commission, but maybe besides the Planning Commission, who is it really that has made this decision? Can we get some names?
I think that's a fantastic question. Of course, you know, previously we'd be thinking about the Baltimore Development Corporation, the Board of Finance, and then the Planning Commission. But going forward, this will next go before the Taxation, Finance, and Economic Development Committee led by Carl Stokes. So the members of that committee then are the actual people that we need to be talking to and pressuring to slow this thing down and to ensure that racial equity and other concerns are really brought to the fore. So we're talking about, I believe, Carl Stokes, Bill Henry, I believe maybe Mary Pat Clark,
Helen
and Helen Holton,
right.
A few others on that committee. I'll look that up. But, you know, those are the people. July 27th, we need to have a magnificent presence there. But even before then, we need to be talking to these elected officials because many of them are already in the corner of Port Covington, of Sagamore, of Under Armour, of Kevin Plank. And I think we need to make sure they're on the side of the people.
And let me go to the phones here again. You guys, people have been holding on for a long time. I'll come right back to both of you. 410-319-8888. Tom, you're on the air. Welcome.
guys for telling it like it is. My name is Tom. I live in Mount Vernon now. I used to live in Brooklyn, Curtis Bay, and I'm familiar with Cherry Hill, too. There's a beautiful view up there, and I got a nickname for Port Covington. I call it Port Coveting because they are looking around for anything they can grab. Cherry Hill is on a 25-year development. In 25 years, Cherry Hill won't exist anymore. There'll That's be right. mansions up that place. It'll probably be a gated community in some sorts. A beautiful view.
Tom, I don't know if you finished up what you were saying, but you're right. I've been saying that for years, mm-hmm. that you look at where Cherry Hill is located. It's right on the water. It has an incredible view. And I think that, that's part of why the discussion, Charlie Carter, has to be about how you have a different vision for what development means in the city and how you make it work. I mean, to me, there's nothing wrong, and maybe you guys will argue with this, but there's nothing wrong with Johns Hopkins University or hospital and their employees getting a discount from moving into the city and staying in the city and working as institutions. But that shouldn't be done at the expense of and not in conjunction with what happens to the residents right now of Perkins Homes, what happens to people who live in communities and why their communities can't be lifted up and the money invested in them. I think that's the problem. It's one-sided. There's no equality or equity here at all in any of the models we've been doing.
Well, Mark, may I say this, that sometimes the people with that development, I don't know if so much of the community meetings or whatever, but they're trying to give people like Westport and Cherry Hill, the poor people, give them hope. But I think they're going to pull it away from them and dash their hopes in the future.
That's the fear.
Yeah, right.
That's the fear.
Tom, appreciate the thoughts and call. Charlie?
I think that I appreciate your observations, and I think that's our fear. We really have to look no further than 35 miles down the road to Washington, D.C., who started this process in 2000, where if you had money in hand and you were a developer, there were no holds barred, there were no rules. It was the Wild West of development. And what we've seen is a city that's been transformed. The people who have, primarily black and brown people who had been in that city and carried it over through the toughest parts, had invested, had lived there for their entire lives, could no longer afford to live in the city. It's now, and the people who are left, the ones who are east of the river, who are left in those communities, are really paying the price because they've seen their property taxes go up, but they're not reaping the benefits of the development that's happened, starting downtown and spreading outward. That has taken up so much of D.C. D.C. is now one of the priciest housing markets in the U.S., and people are slowly making their way up to Baltimore because they can't afford to live there. But, what we saw was developers come in and wholesale move people out of their neighborhoods so that they could redevelop with the promise and the hope that they would be able to come back because there'd be affordable housing, and that they would be able to get jobs. The jobs that were brought were low-wage-paying service sector jobs. The housing was not housing they could ever afford because the average median income that they were looking at for that housing priced them out. Even people who are making money in D.C. can't afford the housing now. I think we don't want to become Washington, D.C. We can take a look at what our development policies have meant right here in Baltimore. Let's look at what's been the outcome for EBDI and how that's helped the poor communities around it. Let's look at what has been the impact of Harbor East, which has proven to be a real big moneymaker for the developers, but, hasn't helped the people of Perkins Homes very much at all. That is really what I fear seeing in Westport and Cherry Hill, where we've already seen a developer get a huge TIF, and where it's been the residents that have paid. We're entering the era of the next Jim Crow. This is where wealthy developers are being subsidized by poor and black and brown taxpayers, And we need to take a stand now and say, not here, not in Baltimore, not now.
Natalie Sherman, welcome to the program. Natalie just joined us. Natalie Sherman is writes about real estate and economic development for The Sun. Good to have you with us, Natalie.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So, that's fine. I'm glad you're with us. So, talk a bit about where you see the issues unfolding around Port Covington, especially with this the coming up for the city council and Carl Stokes kind of also making saying a lot, at least in this program, on the places that he wants to amend this agreement that's been agreed to by every other body. So what do you think is happening here?
Yeah, so I should confess I have these are the calls I will be making this week. There's been a lot of negotiation behind the scenes between Sagamore and both some of the neighborhoods that we've just been talking about, Westport, Cherry Hill, some of those closest to Port Covington, and then also with City Council about sort of what kind of community benefits agreement or what kind of broader sort of commitments they can get from the developer. And I frankly don't know what form that will take. I think a lot of people, what you've been hearing on the show so far, is a lot of people have been more disappointed with the agreements that the city negotiated as it relates to affordable housing and supplier diversity and local hiring. And so I would suspect that those are some of the conversations that they're having. And we might see some councilmen sort of some of their issues that they champion emerge also in those discussions. I frankly don't know. I haven't made those calls yet. But I do think those discussions will start happening this month in a pretty intense way. The first city council hearing on the TIF, I think, is scheduled for July 27th. And so I would expect we start to hear more details in the next few weeks.
You know, Mark,
go ahead.
We've got to tackle this issue of race head on. Because what Port Covington claimed in that planning commission meeting is that they're targeting the creative class. Now, Richard Florida, who created the term creative class, mm-hmm. which are people who I guess do a lot of creative professional work, graphic design, web design, things of that nature. He said on May 9th of this year that 73.8% of all creative class jobs are held by white workers and only 8.5% are held by black workers.
This is from where again?
This is from Richard Florida, who's the guru.
Guy who wrote the book and created the name.
Created the term,
the
book,
right?
So he's saying 8.5% of creative class workers are African American. Well, if that's who they're targeting, then that means that this will be a community that's only 8.5% black. Well, if you look at the Guilford homeland community statistical area, their population is 12% black. Now, Guilford and Homeland have a history of racially restrictive covenants, and they would end up with a higher percentage of African Americans than Port Covington, which would be brand new, in a city that is 63% black. So to only have an 8.5% African American population in a community, in a city that has a long history of racial segregation, and to have a community that's 8.5% black, that's less than a community that has a history of racially restrictive covenants like Homeland, Guilford, Roland Park do, that's absolutely unacceptable.
So the question is, let me ask you all what an alternative plan looks like if this is not the one. Because as an example, I mean, so and with Roland Park and Homeland, I mean, I would half jokingly say that they don't worry about racial discrimination of Homeland and Roland Park. It's all about, I mean, if you're wealthy, you buy a house, you're in.
Right.
Right.
Well,
so
it already happened, right? It was baked into the fabric when right. Edward Boughton founded the Roland Park Company, but was in charge of it, and in 1912 instituted the first racially restrictive covenants in the history of the United States, right here
in Baltimore.
Or in the county at the time, but now part of the city. So what does an alternative plan look like? It looks like saying to Paul Graziano, why don't we include citizens and residents with housing choice vouchers and let's make them 10% of the population down there. That would be 1,400 families, 1,400 black families, as our policies in this country have made public housing in a lot of our urban areas disproportionately black. and in Baltimore, nearly 100% black. So that would be greatly increasing the racial diversity of that community. And that would be in line with the 1968 Fair Housing Act, which was passed 7 days after the assassination of Dr. King and his open housing work that he was doing with desegregation, and the 2015 HUD rule to affirmatively further fair housing, which the Obama administration handed down last year. And so we haven't done anything to affirmatively further fair housing to increase in Port Covington the percentage of black residents in a city that is 63% black. We can't end up with a community that's only 8.5% black in a city that's 63% black. That's creating and intensifying racial segregation. That's unacceptable.
So the question becomes, again, I mean, how that changed. I mean, one of the things you see in the agreements that the city has made so far, in when the memorandum of understanding signed by the developer with the city, they said that a pledge from the developer to, quote unquote, strive to employ an even lower number of city residents, 20%, and strive to fill only 51% of new hires, a pledge to comply with only the city's usual MBEWEB goals, and also not to comply with the minimum standards of city's inclusionary housing law, promising only to try to include a reduced 10% of affordable housing units, affordable at 80% of the AMI, far above the money that retail workers and other most residents can afford. So to make, I should say. So the question is, I mean, what do you do that? And what kind of conversations have taken place with community leaders who we've not had in the show before? We want to have them on. We have not in this regard anyway, but whether it's Drew Schmidt Perkins from Friends of Maryland and people like Reverend Al Hathaway, who's really, really good folks, but who are clearly want to see this development happen, and how you begin those conversations that democratize the process, that allow this kind of open discussion about what this development should look like and how the money should be developed. I mean, it seems to me that is at the core of this over the next month is how you make that happen. Because go ahead. Is that Charlie?
This is Charlie. That is absolutely what's at the core. And that is the role of our city leadership. That is the function that they are supposed to serve, to be the conveners of those discussions and the holders of those discussions, to make sure that the public gets to have their input, that they are actually hearing from all sides, and that they're trying to broker the best possible deal for the taxpayers of Baltimore City. I want to point out that, you know, it is not good enough to strive to meet the goals that are set forth in law, in Baltimore City, in the state, in the country. It's not good enough to strive to meet those goals. Not when you are asking the taxpayers to foot 77% of the cost of this development. It is not Kevin Plank and Under Armour and Sagamore who are taking the risk here. It is the taxpayers of Baltimore, mostly the taxpayers of Maryland, substantially, and then taxpayers of the United States, because they're asking for more than $500 million from the federal government. I say that Baltimore bears most of that responsibility, because if we see the federal government put $500 million into this project, if we see the state put $200 million into this project, if we see $700 million in tax subsidies plus $535 million in a TIF, that's mostly, we're not likely to see that money show up in any other community. We're not likely to see that money show up in a red line. We're not likely to see the same kind of an investment in a super block or a state center, which is much more connected to impoverished communities, where you might see people, those communities, also step up. This is really a failure of city leaders right now, and we really need the public to put pressure on them to say, on Carl Stokes, on Councilman Jack Young, to say, you are supposed to be the negotiators for and the fiduciary,
the people looking out for the finances of Baltimore City, we need you to do a better job of brokering a deal to make sure that all of Baltimore benefits from this, that it's not communities who will see further another decade of disinvestment because we choose to put all of our eggs in this basket. That the city leaders are really responsible. And I also want to point out that we're not opposed to this. I know, like, Under Armour likes to say, or Sagamore likes to say, there are those who, if you're not with us, then you're against us. We're not against seeing this development. We just want to make sure that it's done in a fiscally responsible manner and that Baltimore gets the most out of their investment in this project as possible.
And Natalie, I'm just coming back to you, Natalie Sherman. I'm, yeah. So as this unfolds, I'm really very curious as to the kind of things you want to kind of look at, and investigate.
So I think there are a couple things. I want to mention one thing as it relates to Charlie's comments. She said 77% of this development is funded by sort of some form of taxpayer public involvement, and that is for the infrastructure. I think that percentage is probably close to right, if not right. I don't have the numbers in front of me. But there will be a lot of private investment doing the actual building so that it's a $5.5 billion project. And Sagamore, that is a talking point they are insistent on, but I do think it's fair to mention. And as it relates to, you know, what kind of agreements could be brokered, one of the things that I think is really tough when I'm reporting on this stuff is, you know, who is representing who. And so if you talk to Mike Middleton and Reverend Hathaway, who's working with Sagamore, you know, I've been told that the conversations right now are very transactional, Natalie, you know, and so people are talking about, okay, if we create a ball field on this park, can we ensure that a team from Cherry Hill gets to use it X percent of the time or has first priority? And say, you know, I think people are thinking specifically about some things, and we don't know what those agreements might look like yet, but who's representing who and who's negotiating on behalf of who is sort of one of the tough things. As it relates to going forward and questions that I have, a lot of that has to do with the state and federal money, and that's some, you know, among the calls I'm making this week. One is about sort of what kind of negotiations, what kind of conversations are happening. The other one is really looking at what happens if some of this federal and state money doesn't come through. The state has been sort of more hesitant than the city, you know, has committed to a first phase matching funds that are contingent on a federal award. And so I think that that's a question that I'm pretty curious about, is how important city leaders think this project is and how much they're willing to be out in front as it relates to the public sort of contribution.
Those are really critical questions, I think, that we have to find out, and that we have this month to do this in, just about a little less than a month. And I think, Lawrence, that, I mean, one of the issues here is, I mean, let's say for argument's sake that the deal with Sagamore wasn't to their liking in terms of what they get and what they have to give in return, the things that you and others have been kind of pushing for. Let me just digress and say we've asked Sagamore to come on. We're going to continue to ask Sagamore to join us in the air along with, and we will be calling Reverend Hathaway, who we know well, and some others to join us to talk about this in dialogue here on the program. But you could easily just say, okay, well, we'll just do this. We don't need any of your money, and we're going to make this the enclave you don't want to see, Lawrence.
Well, I mean, they can't do it without our money. They can't do it without our infrastructure. They can't do it without our permission. They can't do it without breaking the law. And the law is that we must affirmatively further fair housing. That is the law of the United States of America that Dr. King gave his life for in 1968. That bill was passed 7 days after his assassination, after sitting in Congress for 2 years. So for black city leaders and others to not pay heed to that law is to assign Baltimore to further hypersegregation for the next 50 years. And that's completely unacceptable. Now, I was wrong earlier. Mary Pat Clark is not on that committee. It's Carl Stokes, Bill Henry, Warren Branch, Helen Holton, and Edward Risinger.
Risinger, that's right.
Those are the five people that are on that committee. Now, in 2013, Stokes and Henry voted against Harbor Point TIF. So if they stick, we really need one of the other three to vote against Sagamore to slow it down or to make sure that there's racial equity first before any support goes toward this.
So the question I have before we run out of time here, and that for the three of you, and I can start with you, Lawrence, we can go around the room. So what does that look like to ensure a racial equity, to ensure that there is also economic equity in the sense that there's inclusionary housing and that the people that this has not become a gated community. This is a huge project. There'll be like another city being built over the next 25 years. Mm-hmm. So what exactly are you and Charlie and others saying about what you want to see?
I'm saying, or we're saying, that there's a better citywide benefits agreement that can be put into place. Brace has drafted one. And what can be done is simply to follow, if not the law in terms of the way it's written with the Fair Housing Law, but follow the intent of the inclusionary housing law. Don't skirt the 20% and say we're going to strive for 10% and then end up at 3% and say, oh, well, we tried. That's what we want. We want equity broadly implemented at every phase of the project, and none of this sort of astroturfing that is sort of going on where Sagamore is soliciting the community's input and presenting it as if the community is saying certain things.
So
this is Natalie. I would just caution people as it relates to the inclusionary housing and the affordable housing. I mean, how affordability is defined is another thing that I think people should really be looking about, and that would play a big role in this discussion going forward. Because right now, as it stands, the way the city and the federal government and the terms of the state, the way they define affordability, I think a lot of families would not think is affordable. I mean, market rate rent is $1,200 or something like that for a family of two. I'm going to have garbled that a little bit, but it's not what I think a lot of people think of as affordable, and that the incomes that are considered the target range incomes are significant when you look at the incomes in the city where, you know, 25% of families live below the poverty line. So that doesn't directly address Professor Brown's point about race, but I do think it's something that would need to be something that people are thinking about.
And that's a very critical point, and we're out of time. So, Charlie, I'm sorry I couldn't get you back in on the final thought here. Charlie Carter, Executive Director of the Maryland Working Families. Natalie Sherman, you just heard, who covers real estate and economic development for The Sun and covering this issue. Natalie, so much for joining us, and that last comment was, I think, really important, and we'll be covering that. Dr. Lawrence Brown, Assistant Professor in the Department of Health and Public Policy here at Morgan State University. We will be linking to his New York Times piece, and let me encourage you all to go to Brace on Facebook and see the dialogue he's created around this issue on Facebook, which I think is very important. We'll be coming back to this by the end of the week, and of course every week, and all the way through the council hearings, and be there at the council hearings ourselves. So I want to thank the three of you so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. So on the way out of here, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. Belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Milton. Our interns are Morgan Barber and Calvin Perry. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Screen Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. And to podcast The Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. Listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.